Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs, in for Carrie Miller. Prosecutors say they're reviewing a report prepared by University of Minnesota investigators on allegations of sexual assault by several members of the Gopher football team. Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman says his office will review the report, but has made no indication as to whether the review means he might reopen the investigation. 10 Gopher football players were accused of being involved in the sexual assault of a female student. The players were not charged criminally, but an internal on-campus investigation found them guilty of violating the school conduct policy and recommended discipline ranging from probation to expulsion. Coming up this hour, we're going to look at the different paths for investigating sexual assaults on campus and how criminal investigations differ from Title IX investigations. First, though, I'm joined by NPR's Peter Cox, who's going to take us through the major points of this particular case. Good morning, Peter.
Hi, Marianne.
So, Peter, let's go back to the night of September 1st, early morning of September 2nd. What does the victim say happened?
Well, she went to the Gopher football game on September 1st and afterwards went to multiple parties around campus. And she ended up at the apartment building where several Gopher football players lived. There she got into a room with some Gopher football players. They had sex. Whether or not there was consent is kind of gray, you know, according to the report so far. And then many more football players came into the room and engaged in sex with her. She said she was confused, overpowered, and dazed, and at some point was kind of unclear on what was happening. So she later reported multiple sexual assaults to both police and campus officials.
So what did the police find?
Well, they interviewed her and they interviewed about five or six football players. And there's differing accounts in that report on whether there was clear consent. Police looked at three video clips, looked at the players' phones, got some DNA samples, etc. In the end, they decided to send the case to the Hennepin County Attorney's Office to take a look at the case. The Hennepin County Attorney's Office declined to charge. They said, quote, there is insufficient admissible evidence for prosecutors to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that either force was used or that the victim was physically helpless, as defined by law in the sexual encounter.
And since that police report, she, along the same time, she did file for a restraining order.
Right. I think she filed for a restraining order in civil court, a temporary restraining order. And that's kind of when the case became more public because it forced players to miss home games at TCF Bank Stadium. That happened, I think, in mid-October. The restraining order was lifted in early November when they came to an agreement about these football players staying away from her and that there might not be civil suits in either direction.
Mm-hmm. And now, at the same time, there's this investigation by the Office of Equal Opportunity and Affirmative Action on the University of Minnesota campus. When did this investigation get underway, and how did that parallel the police investigation?
So it was about 2 to 3 weeks later, I think it was September 23rd, when she reported to the EOAA. Now, the EOAA is the university's office that investigates sexual assaults on campus as required by federal guidelines. So they brought that. They kind of do their own separate investigation. They have separate investigators. They might share information with police, but they do interviews, things like that.
And so how does the substance, or what did the EOAA conclude as compared to the police report?
Well, it found all 10 of these players guilty. Now, I think it's important we explain here that the standard of evidence they use is different than a criminal court. In the criminal court, as you've probably heard, they use beyond a reasonable doubt. But in civil court and in an on-campus investigation, they use the preponderance of evidence standard, meaning if there's a if it's more likely than not to have happened, they can find guilt.
50.1% chance versus, an overwhelming amount of guilt.
Right, right. I think it's also important to point out that there are, you're dealing with student code of conduct rather than criminal law in this
right.
EOA investigation.
So what they're finding them guilty of is something different.
Right. And consent on the U of M is a little bit stricter than you'd find in a criminal court. They use affirmative consent. I think the wording here, it's, quote, informed freely and affirmatively communicated willingness to participate in sexual activity that is expressed by clear and unambiguous words or actions.
So the idea is that rather than saying that if it's rape if somebody says no, the idea here is that it's rape if both parties did not say yes.
Right, right.
Okay. And so how does the substance of the EOAA's report differ from the police report? There's this 82-page report that's been released that people can read through that has a lot of detail in it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the key differences is there's just a lot more detail in the EOA report. Minneapolis police interviewed 5 or 6 people, maybe a few more. But, it's a much shorter report. The EOAA report, I think, interviews well more than 20 people and really kind of gets in to the narrative of the night from many different perspectives and also kind of calls into reflection whether or not someone is credible, why stories might have changed, things like that.
So now, where does this leave the 10 players cited in the investigation? We're going to see, we mentioned that there's a possibility of expulsion, suspension, but also lawyers have indicated that they're going to appeal?
Right. So what happens is the EOAA report is given to each of these students. And there's a letter saying what codes of conduct they violated, but also it gives a possible disciplinary action. In this case, that ranges from probation to expulsion. But the student can either say, yes, I agree to this, or they can say, no, I'll appeal. The attorney for all the players has said they plan to appeal, and that should have happened in the last few days.
And then as we've heard in the news, their teammates momentarily said they would boycott the Holiday Bowl on December 27th, but that boycott was short-lived. So are they back on track to play?
They are. The boycott started Thursday night, and Friday, sometime midday, KSTP released both that EOAA report and the police report. And just the details of what are in that report kind of led to this backlash online, and Star Tribune reports that even the players' parents were kind of questioning what they were doing. Friday night, players met with university administrators, and by the morning, they announced that the boycott was over. One of the things the players said in that morning meeting on Saturday was that we do not want to be misinterpreted as standing up for sexual assault. I think they kind of saw, how this was looking. And they said they plan in the future, they haven't said how yet, to bring more exposure to the issue of sexual violence and harassment against women.
Peter Cox, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Peter Cox is NPR's reporter who's been covering the developments in the sexual assault charges against 10 Gopher football players. We're talking this hour about sexual assault on student campus in light of recent events surrounding those 10 Gopher football players at the University of Minnesota. They were accused of sexually assaulting a female student. The players were not charged criminally, but an internal on-campus investigation found them guilty of violating the school conduct policy and recommended discipline ranging from probation to expulsion. Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman now says his office is reviewing the school's findings. It's not clear whether the review means he might reopen the investigation. This hour, we're going to talk about the different types of investigations of a sexual assault on campus. There's the criminal investigation investigation conducted by law enforcement, and then there's also a Title IX investigation conducted by the college or university. We're going to parse out the differences between those two types of investigations in an effort to better understand the current case unfolding at the University of Minnesota. I'm joined in studio by Susan Gertner, former Ramsey County attorney and now an attorney with Gray Plant Moody Law Firm. Susan, welcome.
Good morning, Marianne.
We're also joined by Carl Crosby Lehman, general counsel at St. Olaf College. Carl, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
And joining us via Skype from Crosby, Minnesota, is Lieutenant Kevin Randolph, who served for years as a sex assault investigator for the University of Minnesota's Police Department. Lieutenant Randolph, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And we'd also like to hear from you. If you have questions about how these cases are investigated or the differences between a Title IX investigation and an investigation by law enforcement, this is your hour. However, I should let you know, if you want to talk about the persistence of rape culture or rape amongst athletes, save those questions for Tom Weber and his guests at 11 o'clock. That is where you will best be served. But if you want to understand the legal process around prosecuting sexual assault, now is the time to call in. You can reach us at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. Or toll free at 1-800-242-2828. That's 1-800-242-2828. You can also reach us online at nprnews.org/live. Carl Crosby Lehman, why does the university have to conduct its own investigations into sexual assault?
I would say that colleges and universities want to address sexual assault on their campuses. They feel an obligation to protect the safety for members of their community. And so there, even before the Dear Colleague letter in 2011, there was this was a focus on all college and university campuses. But in 2011, there was clearly a change in focus, and the Department of Education issued a Dear Colleague letter and made it clear to institutions that they were going to step up their enforcement efforts. And so that was the start of many years of legal changes. And so in 2011, we had the Dear Colleague letter. It generally said institutions should be focusing their sexual harassment enforcement on all types of sexual harassment, including the most severe forms, which would be sexual violence on campus.
Yeah, no, this was, and this came from the Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights. And this really came under the leadership of the Obama administration. I think the same day Vice President Joe Biden came out making a great speech about saying that sexual assault was a civil rights issue for women. So this is something that you saw come out of the Obama administration?
Absolutely. And at that time, I think it became widely known that the statistics of 1 in 5 women are either victims or they suffer attempted rape during their college years. So that was the start. And then a few years later, we had a lot of the Dear Colleague letters, mandates codified in a reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. And then just this last year, we had a state law go into effect in Minnesota that added to the requirements that colleges and universities have to follow.
Are there cases of sexual assault on campus that the school cannot investigate it, under Title IX?
No, if an institution is aware of any type of sexual harassment, including sexual violence, that may impact either a student or an employee's experience, their educational experience in a program or activity that the university or college has, then they have a legal obligation to take steps to address it.
Even if the accused is not a staff or a student?
Yes. If it has a possibility of impacting a student's educational environment, even if the alleged perpetrator is not a member of the community, then institutions still have an obligation. Now, how they respond to it may be very different than the way they'd respond if it was another student who was the accused student.
Susan Gertner, the Hennepin County Attorney's Office decided not to press charges against the football players. What does it take for law enforcement to take on a case like this? What was missing?
You can't say across the board what it takes in any given case. Mm-hmm. What I will say, though, is having reviewed the police reports as they were available publicly online and reviewing the university's report, it's almost as if it was two different incidents that were being described. The tone and, again, the level of detail, which you've alluded to, are starkly different. And so in the case of the decision that was made by the county attorney back when reviewing the police reports, the county attorney has to be able to not only know that a rape occurred and that certain individuals were, in fact, the ones who did it. You have to go beyond that and be able to prove your case beyond a reasonable doubt. And based on these police reports, it is understandable why that decision couldn't be made.
And again, just to underscore what we heard from Peter Cox, that there is a difference in standard of evidence with the Title IX investigations. There's preponderance of evidence versus beyond a reasonable doubt. And how significant a difference is that in looking at the two cases?
It's very significant. And that is why the universe of things that happen that shouldn't have, that can actually turn into a case that goes to a jury, it's a much smaller group of incidents that can be dealt with in the criminal justice system. And one thing I think is a very important dynamic is that ultimately, as I say, you need to prove your case beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury. And the fact remains, and I've been doing this kind of work involved with sexual assaults kinds of cases for three decades, and there still persists a perception that rape is only happening if someone jumps out of the bushes and sexually assaults a perfect stranger. And that's a dynamic that, as a prosecutor, you have to be realistic about.
Carl, you look like you wanted to add something to that a little earlier when talking about preponderance of evidence.
Yeah, it's very possible that, and we don't know the specific details, so I'm not suggesting I know, but it's very possible that the Hennepin County attorney's decision was right in that they may not have had enough evidence to bring a case forward, and that the University of Minnesota's decision was right in that a preponderance of the evidence established that there were violations of their policies.
We're talking this hour about sexual assault on campus, and you can reach us with your question or comment. We're talking about the differences in investigations, the criminal process, and then also the Title IX on-campus investigative process. You can call us with your comment or question at 651-227-6000 or toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. You can also reach us online at mprnews.org/live. Lieutenant Randolph, you worked for the University of Minnesota's Police Department. Where did you fit in all of this? Which laws were you enforcing, the campus or criminal law?
Well, a little bit of both, but primarily the criminal law. The University of Minnesota has its own police department, and I was the primary sex crimes investigator there for the last 5 years of my career. With the university.
And so when you investigated a sexual assault on campus, who was on the investigating team?
Pretty much me. And then I had a partner that I would work with from time to time, but I was the primary criminal investigator for the university.
And so what kind of training did you have for this? I mean, was this separate from law enforcement training or similar? How did it work for as an investigator on campus?
Well, building on to my criminal investigation experience, I took a lot of separate training in sexual assault and interviewing sexual assault victims and witnesses. It was an ongoing process to build myself up to be able to better communicate, because it is a very different kind of investigation when you're talking to a robbery victim versus a victim of sexual assault.
Mm-hmm. And as someone who has worked both as a municipal police officer and on a university campus, how would you characterize the differences between the two types of investigations?
They're very different. I mean, campus is always a different world. You've got your sum total of your population is a group of young adults, most of whom are out on their own for the first time, making decisions on their own for the first time. Alcohol always plays a more prevalent role in those cases. And, you know, you've it's a very different culture than you get in a regular municipal police department.
And in terms of how you felt about the two different types of investigation, is there one you feel more comfortable with, or, you know, when, as somebody who's involved in the process, do you think one is more likely than the other to get justice for the victim?
I think that when you have a dedicated campus police department, they are a lot better trained and a lot more used to dealing, again, with this subset of the total culture. You just learn more about how students think, how they communicate. You have a lot more skills dedicated when you're only working on those cases, as opposed to, you know, for example, Minneapolis Police Department. They're going from, you know, the rape case that Susan suggested of somebody jumping out of the bushes with a knife, and then they're going on to, you know, maybe a child molestation case the next day, and then they get a student case the day after that, and then they're having to adjust their mindset on the fly, whereas the university police department, we're primarily only dealing with the student population.
So when you look at the two different outcomes of these, you know, the criminal investigation versus what happened on campus with the Title IX investigation, are you surprised at the difference in the results, or does this make sense to you?
Oh, I'm not surprised at all. And, you know, as Susan said before, it's almost like reading two different cases, but you have to understand that, especially dealing with the student population, they all watch TV. They all, you know, they've all taken a pre-law class, and they all are aware that they do not have to cooperate with the police. They do not have to answer questions. They cannot be compelled in any way. But when they get a letter from EOAA saying, if you don't come in and talk to us, you may face sanctions from the university, their cooperation turns on fully. I mean, they don't want to, they know they can't be arrested, but they know they can be kicked out of school for not cooperating. So especially the witnesses tend to give a lot more information in an EOAA investigation than they would in a criminal investigation.
Okay. Carl Crosby Lehman, let's talk a little bit about due process. For those who aren't familiar with the term, what exactly it means, and why campuses don't have to follow it.
It means different things in different contexts. In the context of sexual assault investigations conducted by colleges and universities, that concept comes out of the Violence Against Women Act reauthorization, and there are due process requirements that institutions have to follow. They have to the proceedings have to be conducted by officials who are trained and do not have a conflict of interest or any bias. They have to give the parties an opportunity to be heard and to suggest witnesses and provide evidence. They have a right to an advisor of their choice, which under the Violence Against Women Act made it clear that that includes a lawyer. So institutions now are having to deal with their processes with not only the students, but with their lawyers present as well. Students have a right to review all of the evidence that the adjudicators are going to review in making their decision. And so there is a lot of due process that's required under the law.
And yet there are certain things that are not required for, say, in a case that happens on campus, that there's we have, let's see here, when we're looking at they have the ability to, the accused does not get to counter interview or, you know,
Cross-examine.
To cross-examine, exactly.
Yep. So there's a lot of complaints about how much due process is provided, and accused students, that's one of the things they often point to, is mm-hmm. the inability to cross-examine. Institutions are juggling a lot of competing interests here when they handle these matters. And on the one hand, they want to make it fair and impartial. On the other hand, they don't want to have a process that re-victimizes an individual or adds to the trauma. And so different institutions will address that differently. A lot of institutions will have the accused student and, well, both parties have the right to suggest questions, and the panel or the investigator will ask those questions. But that's a way that the important questions are – there's certainty that those important questions are going to be asked, while at the same time not having to have somebody who may have had a very traumatic situation with an individual having to have a face-to-face conversation with them.
We're talking this hour about sexual assault on college campuses and the difference in the investigation process between a criminal investigation and a Title IX on-campus investigation. You can call us with your question or comment at 651-227-6000. You can also reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. Let's go to the phones. We've got Sarah on the line in Stillwater. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good
Thank
morning.
You for taking my call.
You bet.
I had a question, and it was regarding the Title IX investigation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's been some focus, at least in the media, regarding bias with Title IX investigations conducted by, you know, either university police or, I guess, however that works, within universities and colleges. My question is, how are university police, or if there are other people, you know, in addition to that, that carry out the Title IX investigations, how are they appointed in such a way that, you know, we can eliminate some of that bias? Do they work, in fact, for the college? Do they work for some sector of the government? How do we eliminate that bias?
All right, Sarah, thanks. Carl?
Sure. The different institutions, there's a lot of latitude under the law to address this in the way the institution deems most appropriate. On our campus, for example, we retain outside investigators who have no connection to our campus to conduct our investigations. By law, institutions can have somebody internally or externally, but they are required to have training on various things. The Violence Against Women Act has many requirements for the training that investigators and adjudicators have to receive, including training on the neurobiology of rape trauma and on how to make credibility determinations. So these, you know, you often hear the sentiment, shouldn't this be left to the professionals? And I often respond, yes, it should be left to the professionals. These are professionals. These are individuals who receive extensive training. They are extremely competent. They are also individuals who care deeply about the students in the community, both the accused students and the individuals who come forward and report that they've been a victim.
Isn't it true, though, that there are many people who serve on these panels that are faculty who have maybe gotten a day's worth of training in terms of how to handle some of these cases and how to investigate, how to determine who's at fault?
It's true that some institutions have a hearing panel, and some institutions even have students sitting on their panels. I'm not sure about the level of training they receive, but it is required that they do receive training on a number of different aspects. And another sentiment that I often hear is, you know, you're potentially making a very serious decision on such a low standard of proof. Well, that's actually a quite common standard of proof in our civil justice system. We make lots of really important decisions about people's lives, about their jobs, their businesses, their families, their bank accounts. And those fact finders, jurors, are making the decision based on the same standard review, and they're not getting nearly the training in making the decision that on-campus officials are receiving when they're making a decision in a sexual assault case.
Susan Gertner, in the U's 82-page report, this is the EOAA's report, it states that the Hennepin County Attorney's Office did not share information gathered by the Hennepin County Police Department. Is that normal?
When an investigation occurs prior to any charging decision being made, or if a decision is made not to charge, there are certain privacy expectations and rules about what you can and cannot share with the public. And so the fact that in particular the the school's report was leaked is a product of, if you will, somebody circumventing that privacy system. And so we have in this case a lot more information than we typically do. And you can understand why there are rules about what can and cannot be shared in the context of a police investigation, because in some instances a police investigation may occur. The suspect may, in fact, be innocent, and if you're that suspect or a loved one of that suspect, you don't want that information all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Do the agencies, the campus and the police department, ever collaborate?
Well, I would expect that there would be collaboration. And one thing that I react negatively to, criticism of the institutions, of the universities, the colleges, in terms of they're not up to this job or they don't have the proper training, leave it to the professionals, et cetera. As Carl indicated, they are professionals. And moreover, law enforcement is simply cannot do everything. The law enforcement agencies need to focus on, again, this somewhat narrower circumstances of behaviors that can and should be prosecuted in the criminal justice system. But there's all kinds of other things that go on that might not be a provable criminal case, but that are wrong or not good, and they don't meet the expectations of an institution like a college. And so the fact that there are other professionals outside of the criminal justice system working on investigating and holding people to standards, that's a good thing.
We're talking this hour about sexual assault on college campuses and how they're prosecuted both on campus and at the criminal level. We've been talking with Carl Crosby Lehman. He's general counsel for St. Olaf College. We're talking with Susan Gertner, former Ramsey County attorney, and she's now an attorney with Gray Plant Moody. We're also talking with Lieutenant Kevin Randolph, who's a former University of Minnesota Police Department sex assault investigator. He's currently a lieutenant in Crosby, Minnesota. We're going to get back to the conversation and your calls in just a moment. But first, it's time for a news update with Phil Picardi.
Good morning, Marianne. German authorities are seeking a new suspect in the deadly truck attack on a Christmas market in Berlin. The suspect is thought to be a Tunisian man with ties to Islamic extremists. The man's wallet was found in the cab of the truck that ran over shoppers Monday evening. 12 people died and nearly 50 were injured. A spokesman for Russian President Vladimir Putin is refusing to offer theories behind Monday's assassination of the Russian ambassador to Turkey, but he is hinting Moscow does not believe the gunman acted on his own. Ambassador Andrei Karlov was killed in front of onlookers at a photo exhibition in Ankara, Turkey. Syrian TV says rebel evacuations have resumed from Aleppo, paving the way for the government to take control of that city. Reports say 5 buses arrived at a crossing between the rebel and government sides of the city after rebels handed over pro-government fighters they took prisoner during previous rounds of fighting. Syrian opposition forces agreed to surrender their last foothold in the city last week. Mexican authorities are pledging to find out who's responsible for a deadly chain reaction explosion at a fireworks market that left at least 29 people dead. It was the third such blast to ravage the market on the northern outskirts of Mexico's capital city since 2005. Officials have not yet said what may have caused the explosions, which also burned dozens of people. North Carolina lawmakers are meeting today to consider repealing a state law that prohibits people from using the restroom of their choice in public schools and government buildings. However, there is a last-minute snag. There are concerns officials in the city of Charlotte have not repealed the entire ordinance that prompted passage of the state law. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:39.
Every Wednesday on All Things Considered, get a taste of regional food and drink trends, reviews, recipes, and advice. Our stable of food experts serve it up on Appetites. I'm Tom Cran. What's news and what's for dinner? Join me starting at 3.
I'm Tom Weber. Be sure to tune in at 11 this morning as we continue this conversation that you're hearing about this hour, sexual assault on campus. You're hearing about how investigations work this hour. At 11, we'll broaden out to discuss rape culture and how to address it. Then at noon, a panel discussion that was held this week at the U about the football team boycott. Stay with NPR News.
Programming supported by donors of Planned Parenthood Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota. Planned Parenthood is dedicated to protecting, promoting, and providing comprehensive reproductive health care and education. Planned Parenthood, here for good.
Support comes from Catholic Charities of St. Paul in Minneapolis, dedicated to ending poverty for thousands experiencing homelessness in our community. You can help provide shelter and food with gifts matched through December 31st at cctwincities.org/donate.
You're listening to NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs, in for Carrie Miller. In this hour, we're talking about sexual assault on college campuses and the different ways that they are, the cases are tried. There's both the criminal investigation, then there's also the Title IX investigation that happens on campus. They have very different standards and different outcomes, as we've seen with news reports of the Gopher football team players and how they were found. That no charges were pressed at the criminal level, but there were it was an outcome definitely on the campus level with the Title IX investigation. We're talking with Carl Crosby Lehman, General Counsel of St. Olaf College, Susan Gertner with Gray Plant and Moody, and Lieutenant Kevin Randolph, who's a former sex assault investigator for the University of Minnesota's Police Department. He's a lieutenant now in Crosby, Minnesota. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Jane on the line in St. Paul. Jane, welcome to the show. What's your comment or question?
Hi, I'm calling because I live on a college campus. My partner works here. And so, you know, one thing I think about is that a lot of colleges care so much about their reputations and prospective students. And, you know, students, you know, go around and visit them. There's a lot of energy and time and money poured into the experience that prospective students have. And so I'm wondering, you know, a lot of these cases that are reported to the colleges are never reported to the law enforcement. And I'm wondering about a conflict of interest with the colleges wanting to protect their precious reputations so that people spend $25K per year to go to their institution versus, you know, having these things be reported to law enforcement. And, you know, I don't know anywhere else where 20-somethings get a pass and don't have allegations that are charged against them not be out there in the world other than a college institution. Mm-hmm. If you're anywhere else in the world and you're a kid that can't afford to go to college and somebody alleges that you rape them, it's out there. Why should the college students have it any different?
Okay. Jane, thank you for your comments. I'm going to take this straight to Carl Crosby Lehman and say, so, yeah, there's definitely pressure on a school to maintain a pristine reputation. How does that affect this process?
Yeah, definitely we want to have a positive reputation. Among the things we want to have a good reputation for is that we comply with the law. We take our legal obligations seriously. And so making sure that we respond to these incidents appropriately and promptly and fairly is something that we care deeply about. So I don't know. I agree that there is a concern about reputation, but I think that doesn't dissuade a college from doing the right thing in these cases. With regard to law enforcement, we're legally obligated to encourage our students when they come to us to report it to law enforcement. We make well-lit paths to law enforcement. We have great relationships with our law enforcement, and we encourage them. And if they want to report it to law enforcement, we will assist them in that. If they don't want to report it to law enforcement, we are legally bound to honor that, and we cannot report it to law enforcement.
And you really wouldn't want it any other way.
Yeah.
Because as a victim of sexual assault, I can that person in that position has to make a very difficult decision. Do I want to call police? Do I want this to go through the criminal justice system? And so to say that by participating with, cooperating with a campus process, that somehow that is always a bad thing or a lesson option or lesser option, I think is not respecting the victim's choice. Am I going to call the police? And as Carl indicated, it's not either or. It mm-hmm. is something that they make these student aware of. the victim aware of. You can call the police. You can continue in this process. And I think we need to respect, in some instances, that choice. And again, the two processes can go on at the same time.
Lieutenant Randolph, in your experience working on the campus, are there outcomes that can come from these Title IX investigations that are, say, preferable to a criminal process?
Yeah, in a lot of cases, much like the football player case that we started talking about here today, the cases, you have a victim who wants justice and wants an outcome and tries going through the criminal process, but the case itself just doesn't play out. We don't get enough detail or enough evidence to get it successfully through to prosecution. The Title IX investigation through the university offers an alternative path for them. And again, they generally get more information. They have a lower standard of proof to make a decision. So it offers students a new and easier sometimes path to get the justice that they're looking for.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of timeline, I know in the past there have been complaints that sometimes university investigations took too long, but nowadays, is one process faster than the other typically?
Definitely. Under the law relating to colleges and universities, we are required to complete our process promptly, which the Department of Education has indicated generally a 60-day timeline.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. So as opposed to a criminal investigation, Susan, how long can those go on for?
Well, they can go on for a very long time, or they can be very swift. And a lot of that dynamic is a result of, is there an immediate threat to public safety? Do we have leads? Can we pursue this kind of thing? And so it varies greatly in terms of how quickly the criminal justice system is able to do the kind of investigation that's required to prove a case.
We're talking this hour about sexual assault on college campuses and the different types of investigation around them. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 651-227-6000. That's 651-227-6000. Or you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Stephen on the line from Washington, D.C. Stephen, thanks for joining the conversation.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
By way of background, I used to be an Air Force prosecutor and an Air Force defense attorney, and the military has some of the similar dynamics, both in their cases that involve sexual assault as college campuses do. They tend to be younger people, tend to have alcohol involved. And then there's also a dueling jurisdiction sort of question where the military always retains criminal jurisdiction over any of their people under federal law, but state and local authorities may have jurisdiction as well, and so there's a parsing out that the state may move forward with charges, in which case the military generally won't. But there is a fairly robust administrative discharge process for the military, which follows the same standard of evidence, of a preponderance of the evidence, before an adverse administrative action is taken against the accused. I was wondering if there's been any look towards the military system in terms of trying to inform decision-making in how whether to go forward with an administrative discharge from the college, an expulsion from the college, and in terms of the process, because there's a fairly robust review procedure that a person can go through. There's each service branch has a military board of review for any administrative discharge actions that if you want to pay out of pocket for an attorney, you can try to get into that and have somebody review the decision of the administrative authority, as well as the opportunity of getting into federal court if there's violations of the Administrative Procedure Act, things of that nature.
Okay.
Has there been any similar sort of safeguards put in place for the accused in the event that there's a concern that the hearings have been less than less than thorough, or the investigation was less than thorough?
Sure, let's get the question to Carl. I see you nodding your head here.
It's very similar process and similar dynamics in terms of the individuals that are involved. under the judicial processes that that affect colleges and universities, certainly if an individual feels like they were railroaded in the process, they have the right to either complain to the Office for Civil Rights or to bring a lawsuit. And we frequently see those cases.
And yeah, it has, since the Dear Colleague letter of 2011 from the Office of Education, haven't we seen an uptick in those sorts of lawsuits countering, saying, look, the accused here was not given a proper defense?
Yeah, we've seen an uptick in everything in this area. So we've seen an uptick in reporting. That's a great thing. We've seen an uptick in schools understanding what their legal obligations are and implementing these policies and moving forward with them. And as a result of that, we often talk about the fact that if you can get out of the process with only one of the parties really angry, that's the best you can probably hope for. And so it's very common that you have a party who leaves this internal process not satisfied and looking for other ways to challenge the decision.
Susan Gertner, is there a legitimate concern there that this is this process on campus is too much in favor of the accuser and does not do enough to defend the accused?
I think that due process is in the eyes of the beholder. I think that bias of an investigation or whatever also is in the eye of the beholder. And so I think that I've certainly worked with victims, victims' families who feel like the whole system is stacked in favor of the defendant. And then, of course, I've worked with defendants who feel like the whole system's stacked against them. So I think to say across the board that a system is in favor of one or the other is it doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. And I would also add that you can't really do a side-by-side comparison of the criminal justice system, the rules, the expectations versus other institutions as they try to enforce their codes of conduct. There is an entitlement. There is a constitution that protects your life, liberty, and property. And there are all kinds of protections because at the end of the day, if you're found guilty of a crime, you can lose your liberty. You can go to prison. So, of course, as a society, we're going to stack that deck, if you will, in favor of making absolutely sure that the decision is the correct one. That's not a dynamic that translates to these other things. You don't have an entitlement to go to a particular campus. You don't have an entitlement to be in the military. And so to have, if you will, lesser standards of proof, lesser systems in place to protect either side, makes sense.
Well, you know, one of our callers earlier, she mentioned to, we haven't gotten to this part yet, the idea that if a person is convicted of rape on a campus, that is something that should follow them beyond their college years rather than that just be something that's contained within their campus experience. Is that something that is – I know in California there has been some movement looking at whether it should be on a person's job applications, that they were tried on a campus Title IX investigation and found guilty of sexual assault. Is that something that's being looked at here in Minnesota, Carl?
I'm not sure where the legislature is at with that, but as you alluded to, lots of different states are looking at this issue differently. And even without legislation, it's still – a fact that if you're found responsible and you are wanting to transfer to another institution or go to a graduate school, that these are decisions that other institutions want to know about and will inquire about, and it will follow them.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Wendy on the line in Minneapolis. Wendy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I'm curious about how many years a Title IX investigation can go back versus a criminal investigation that can go back a number of years.
Okay, good question. So, Carl, how far back can we investigate a situation, an accusation of a sexual assault on campus?
So the guidepost here is the overall requirement that institutions, when they know or should know about harassment, take prompt and appropriate action to end the harassment, prevent its recurrence, and address its effects. And so with that, there are times where some very old reports of sexual harassment may still be relevant to a current situation on campus. But if it's an older situation and none of the individuals involved are still on campus, then it's not likely to be a Title IX issue. Although I can speak for my institution and say we still want to know about those things. We still are involved in taking action to address those things.
Okay. And Susan, in terms of the criminal aspect of it, how long does somebody have to come and say, no, I suffered this sexual assault and I want to see this charges pressed?
Well, there's a practical answer to that. And then there's, of course, the law. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they aren't coterminous. But as a practical matter, obviously, the longer that a report waits to bring their incident to the attention of the authorities, the less likely it is that the police are going to be able to gather sufficient evidence for a prosecutor to charge the case. There are statutes of limitation, which they vary in terms of the seriousness of the offense and the circumstances and that kind of thing. For example, if you have physical evidence in the form of DNA, there is essentially no statute of limitations to how long that case can be brought. So but again, the longer the person waits, how are you going to find the evidence?
Lieutenant Randolph, I just got a minute left here, but I'm curious, you know, from your experience on both sides of this issue, which do you think is more detrimental to an accused's career or future, the criminal charge or, say, being expelled from school and having that, you know, the stain on your academic record?
Well, I would believe the criminal record, because once you have that, that's not very easy to get rid of or to be hidden. But there are still a lot of student data privacy laws that make it difficult for those types of things to come up in a normal background investigation for a job application, for example.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Susan Gertner, now that we've seen that, you know, Mike Freeman has announced that he's reviewing the university's report, is there a possibility that this case could be reopened? Is that legally possible at this point?
I think that it's understandable why County Attorney Freeman has decided to take another look at that. Again, the two reports read very differently. What I don't want people to think is that therefore charges will not now in the future be issued, because that's too much of a leap. Certainly taking a look at this very detailed report that the university office produced is something that a prosecutor would want to do. And of course, that there's still time to issue charges. Whether or not there'll be sufficient evidence is a very different question.
Thanks to all of you. We've had quite a wonderful conversation this hour. Very detailed, learned a lot in the process. Many thanks to Carl Crosby Lehman, General Counsel of St. Olaf College, Susan Gertner, former Ramsey County Attorney and now an attorney with Gray, Plant & Moody, and Lieutenant Kevin Randolph, former University of Minnesota Police Department Sex Assault Investigator, currently Lieutenant in Crosby, Minnesota. Thanks to all of you. You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio News here on NPR.